Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's Friday, March 22nd, and your Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. Oh, thank you once again for joining us for another episode of The Ben Jarofsky Show. It's Oh What a Week. Ben is ready to talk the top stories of the week. That's right, national news, local news, and so much more this week with Block Club Chicago's own Rachel Hinton. The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for everything that there is to know in the city of Chicago. You want to know what to do, where to go, what to eat, what to drink. You want to stay updated on what's happening in the arts scene in Chicago. You want to know what's happening in music, in politics? Well, just head to ChicagoReader.com. You'll find it all there. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky, head to ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. That's J-O-R-A-V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this "Oh, What a Difference an Election Makes" Friday, and here's why. Actually, we're calling this "Oh, What a Week." Rachel Hinton, great reporter, a dear friend of the show from Block Club, is about to join us. It's kind of a ritual. Whenever it's an election, I reach out to Rachel. She's a total political geek, total political nerd, as am I, and a charter member of the Percival Everett Fan Club, of which there are two, maybe three people in the city of Chicago. So we'll talk a little Percival Everett at the end of our political conversation. So first of all, Rachel, welcome back. It's just good to see you. I'm going to start with the first topic, okay? And why I call this "Oh, What a Difference an Election Makes." So, of course, on Tuesday, there was a primary, exceedingly low turnout. We can talk about that. One of the quote unquote losers of the primary was Iris Martinez, who is the clerk of the circuit court. And man, what a difference from 4 years ago. She stunned people 4 years ago. She didn't have the party's nomination. She was victorious in the primary. She then was elected in the general election. She just seemed to have so much momentum going her way. So then Iris Martinez made what I guess is a political miscalculation, or maybe she was following her heart, but she moved to the right. She joined forces with John Catanzara, Fraternal Order of Police, Rachel. And the results have been pretty bad for her electorally. You could argue that there were setbacks for the left in Tuesday's election, but one triumph for the left was Rosanna Rodriguez, the alderwoman of the 33rd Ward, and her political organization and her allies pretty much did a number on Iris Martinez. Not only did Iris lose her county clerk's race countywide, but she also lost the committeeman's race to Rosanna pretty decisively. 59%, I want to say, was the last number I saw. Rosanna Rodriguez was elected committeeman. Iris Martinez is out as county clerk and out as committeeman, committee woman. Your thoughts, Rachel, on what all this says about voters in the area, not far from where you live, actually, not far from where I live, in the 33rd Ward in Albany Park area. Go ahead.
Yeah, Iris Martinez's night on Tuesday was pretty crazy to watch after her night 4 years ago. I mean, when she sailed into that office, not only did she lose her actual job, she lost her committeeman position, and the state senator she supported and ended up helping to get appointed to that seat also lost. Kind of working backward there, when she ran for Cook County clerk of the circuit courts, she ran against the slated candidate, Michael Caponardi, who's on the county's property tax appeal board. She ran against Mariana Spiropoulos back then, who ended up defeating her Tuesday night this time around, who's also like a big county politician whose name has been out there for a long time. And then Richard Boykin, who was a county board member. But then, you know, as a committee person, she was able to slate or help get people appointed to, or rather like the two big appointments I'm pretty sure she had a role in, were Christina Pasion Zayas, who was a, I want to say, state senator, who now works in the city's mayor's office. And then, you know, obviously this state senator, who she, you know, who also lost Tuesday night. And then also Frank Aguilar, who was on the Cook County board, board of commissioners. So, you know, yes, it sucks that she lost Tuesday night her actual job, but she also was losing a considerable amount of power by losing that other role she had. I think in her, you know, Tuesday night kind of concession speech, you know, she said Spiropoulos basically bought the seat, and she basically alluded to potentially like riding off into the sunset and enjoying her life with her family, and getting to, like, you know, actually do the quiet sort of fun, relaxing times that people tend to allude to when they've lost an election. I'll be really curious to see if that actually happens. Like, Iris Martinez is not somebody that I think of as being kept down. Or I totally expect her to come back. In what capacity? I mean, that remains to be seen, especially when, you know, her tenure as clerk was mired in sort of the same sort of machine politics or accusations of that. And she wasn't able to hold on to it. So, like, is she still relevant, I think, is a question too.
Yeah. The state senators that you were alluding to, she used her vote. So this is, if there are any rookie listeners out there, our listeners, rates are pretty politically sophisticated junkies. So they know how to game works, but when there's a vacancy for a legislative seat, like with a state senate, the committeemen who are in the district get together and they have a weighted vote, and they select a temporary replacement who fills the office until there's a next election. And so when Zayas left to become chief of staff or to go to work for Brandon Johnson, that left a vacancy, and effectively Iris Martinez had the weighted vote to cut a deal with Alderman Scott Wagasback to bring in Natalie Toro to be the state senator, and over Gracio Guzman, who wanted the position and was an ally of the lefties in the area, the progressives in the area, whatever you want to call them, and made it clear that she was going to run. And, you know, like I said, it's Monday morning quarterbacking on my part. I realize that. And maybe it's just impossible for Iris Martinez to have reached out to leftists in her district. But, man, what a blunder. Because clearly that area has changed dramatically. And that used to be Richard Mel's. I know you know this, but that used to be Richard Mel's ward. And then he turned it over to his daughter, Deb Mel. And it's just, it's probably one of the leftiest wards or the leftiest areas in Chicago. And this is like Albany Park area, just west of where Rachel and I actually live. And so political miscalculation, I would say, to put it mildly, on the part of Iris Martinez. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe she just, in her heart of hearts, Rachel was incapable of making that ideological move to try to embrace Rosanna Rodriguez and try to move to the left. If you follow me, you know what I'm saying? Maybe she's just too entrenched in her ways. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I know. I'd agree with that. I mean, I have a lot of questions about that. I think the last time around, she tried to unseat Rodriguez, Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, or rather put up a really formidable fight against Rodriguez Sanchez to try to get her out of that seat. And basically, it seems like she's Martinez has been trying to really stir the pot in that ward. And it seems like an ideological fight between the lefties, the more progressives, and, you know, the people like Martinez, who maybe aren't there yet, who aren't as far left as Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez or, you know, the progressive kind of ilk on the city council that we have now. But ultimately, and I think last time, and I think this time especially, it shows, no, there are some really left-leaning people there, and you got to go with the times or else you're going to get kicked out. And, you know, right now she's been kicked out, so who knows what she'll come back and do, but hopefully she sees the writing on the wall.
Yeah, it was a bad move, to say the least, to ally yourself with John Catanzarian in that area. I'll just give you an indication of the political leanings of the 33rd Ward these days. In the referendum that we're going to be talking about next, Bring Chicago Home, 61% of the voters voted yes. It was in the top 10 of wards with the highest yes vote. That measure went down to defeat. I don't know if it's finalized yet. Rachel, I don't know if the Chicago Board of Elections has finalized that election, but it sure looks like they're waiting for mail-in votes to be counted, but it sure looks like it's going down. Your thoughts on what happened with that referendum?
Yeah, I don't know that it's finalized yet. I think that they're still waiting for those mail-in ballots to be completely counted. I want to say as of this morning or maybe late last night, I want to say the no vote was like 54%. I don't know, 46% or something like that. People know how to do math. I think that, you know, playing Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon quarterback, the mayor said or seemed to allude to but didn't actually say that the messaging could have been better or clearer around the referendum vote. But it seems like that's what a lot of older people and the mayor in some ways seem to be saying. They seem to acknowledge, okay, we could have done this better, but also this isn't it. You know, just because this measure didn't pass doesn't mean that we're going to give up on trying to find different ways to help fund and help address homelessness. My colleague, Ariel Perella, did a story talking to some of the older people, some of the advocates about what could potentially be next. Some older people alluded to, you know, oh, we're already looking at other taxes that maybe we could, you know, move the revenue stream toward supporting homelessness services and perhaps other affordable housing options, permanent supportive housing, temporary supportive housing, et cetera. I mean, I think that time will tell whether or not, or rather, where that goes. I think people are right now still kind of licking their wounds, are still kind of like sad about Tuesday, understandably so. I mean, I think everybody would agree that something needs to be done. And I think it sounds like from the mayor's press conference the other day, he knows that something could have and should have been done differently. Whether or not that is done, you know, next time around, if there is a next time, remains to be seen.
Yeah. There are many problems with the referendum. We've talked about it a lot on the show. But one thing that struck me in the aftermath of Tuesday, and in so many ways, it just came down to like a referendum on Mayor Johnson. This is how I see it, Rachel. Get your thoughts on this. So if in a general sense, you're with Mayor Johnson, you voted yes. In a general sense, if you're against Mayor Johnson, you voted no. And I say this because there's some instances where people were voting their pocketbooks. So when I take a look at, like, say, the 42nd Ward, which is the Gold Coast, which is sort of the most expensive real estate in the city, this would have increased the sales tax on property, high-end property. So folks in that area would have paid more in taxes for selling their property. It's a one-shot deal, but they would have paid more. And so they had an economic vested interest in voting no. All right. And so it was a very high no vote, 74%. Then you looked at the 19th Ward on the southwest side of Chicago. I don't know if there's a lot of property in the 19th Ward that would have been hit hard with this tax, you know, or the 41st Ward on the northwest side of Chicago. There's a lot of policemen and firefighters in those wards. I don't think they're living in multi-million dollar mansions or condos. And the no vote, Rachel, was 80% in the 41st Ward and 74% in the 19th Ward. To me, that's just like, oh, Mayor Johnson's for it, we're against it. that's kind of my read for it. Like, why would people, I understand why 42nd Ward voters would be against it because it's not in their economic interest. But middle-class voters in the 19th and 41st Ward, it's in their economic interest to have voted for it. Something else is at play there. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, I would agree. I want to say it was Fran Spielman's, like, you know, next day story on where Burning Chicago Home stands. There was an unnamed source in there who talked about, you know, Johnson thought that he would be able to get this through because he thought that his election to the mayor's office, to the fifth floor, was a referendum. Like, was the city saying, we support you, we're here for you, like, just unilateral support. And that's not what this is. People want to know the plan to spend this money. If we're going to tax people more, they want a better laid out plan for how you're going to spend the money, why you need this money. Okay, what are you going to do with the COVID dollars that the city still has and hasn't used yet? And I don't think that the Johnson administration really has done that yet. And so I think that their reluctance, they're maybe still kind of getting used to the mayor's office, still getting used to this position of power, and figuring out how to use that and what to do with those dollars. I think that kind of bit them in the butt on Tuesday, and ultimately led to this campaign promise, this thing that Johnson campaigned on, failing. And while this may not tank his whole progressive agenda, I mean, it is a big hole in that. Like, what are we going to do, you know, when these COVID dollars dry up? I want to say at the end of 2026 is when they're completely gone. What's going to happen, you know? This problem, these issues, and the fact that people still really need affordable housing, that's not going anywhere. They have to go back to the drawing board, but hopefully the next time around, Johnson and the people around him don't think that, you know, they can get this through just on the fact that people elected him to office.
All right, before we leave this issue completely, I'll give you the trivia question I've been giving every guest who's come on the show Tuesday. I know every guest gets this. I'm not sure any guest has gotten it correct. So here's the trivia question. I asked Graciela Guzman. She was a guest. I asked her this trivia question, and she didn't get it right either. So don't feel bad if you don't get it right. if you view this referendum as a vote on Brandon Johnson, which ward loves Brandon the most? Which ward got the highest yes vote for the referendum in the city?
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's a good question. Yeah. This makes me wish I paid attention to those maps more that people were tweeting. You don't give any hints, west, south, north.
All right, I'll give you a hint. I had to give Graciela Guzman a hint too. My dear friend Mick Dumke lives there.
Oh, okay. So the Rogers Park ward. I want to say, Maria Haddon's the alderman?
Yes.
So 49th?
Okay. 49 is number one. Everybody stumbles when they go number two because they think, it's Carlos Ramirez Rosa's 35th, a bunch of lefties live there,
George
Rodriguez is 33rd. We just talked about how, you know, she and her allies are taking control. No, number two in the city, the fifth ward, Hyde Park.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that makes some sense. I feel like both of those other people have been like stumping for this measure for a long time, by name or otherwise. So
enough trivia question. I will not ask you any more trivia questions. I did an analysis of voting results, which is like a deep dive, total nerd geek out with going precincts by precincts, ward by ward.
I love it.
I know. And I have all these little tidbits of factoids that only geeks would care about, and probably going to write an article about it. All right, let's move on to the issue of crime and politics. It was very much at play in the state's attorney's race, where it was a vacancy. Of course, Kim Fox is stepping down after two terms. She endorsed Clayton Harris, and Eileen O'Neill Burke was endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, Johnny Catanzara. So already you could see, again, an ideological divide. Although Eileen O'Neill Burke said she didn't want Catanzara. I don't know if you saw that. She didn't want the endorsement. She didn't seek the endorsement. So take for her. trying to shore up her support on sort of the lefty side. Again, as we speak, too close to call. I haven't looked at the latest results. Have you seen it? The Burke was ahead, I want to say, by one percentage point last I looked. Is it changed since then?
I haven't seen anything. The last thing I read on it was A.D. Quigg over at the Tribune did a story about how the lead had shrunk from, I think, 8,800 votes to 8,100 votes. I'm sure that that's changed. That story came out, I want to say, last night. But no, I haven't been following the dwindling of votes or the changing the math there as closely as some other things. So,
yeah. So it's neck and neck. The mail-in's going to decide it. I have many theories about this race. What are your theories? Let's just say Burke wins. Go ahead.
Let's say Burke wins, you said?
Yeah. She's ahead now, even if it's just this close neck and neck, what's your sort of general theories about, the issues at this race and the factors in this race?
Yeah, I kind of feel like this is a referendum on not just crime, but on the response to 2020 and on the response to like the rising crime rates that we've seen. So like armed robberies, some shoplifting, et cetera. And I think that it's, do you want more of the Kim Fox policies of trying to reform the system from within, or do you want to follow the federal, or I don't even know if it's the federal, state criminal guidelines as to how to deal with these sorts of things. And I think with Burke being in the lead, I think that's a sign or a referendum on how people want the criminal justice system or the prosecutor's office to work, basically. I think people, are really tired of and scared of the amount of crime that they see in the newspapers and on TV news every night, whether or not they, should be, or whether or not, the crime boogeyman is out to get them, who knows, who's to say, but, people's worries and concerns are valid. And I think that that's why we're seeing Burke in the lead right now over Clayton Harris.
Yeah. I thought, that Burke, my sense going into this particular race, Rachel, was that Burke would win decisively. I just had that feeling, just what we're talking about, like the prevailing trend, not just in Chicago or in Illinois, but throughout the country, had been against progressives in criminal justice positions, in state's attorney's positions. I seem to think like the backlash, as you put it, or as you were talking about, to 2020 was coming home. But then a couple of things made me realize that maybe I had overestimated that point. And follow me on this. This was the high ticket in this election. This was the big race. This was the most high top ballot contested. It was part of the reason why turnout was so low, in my humble opinion, there was no competition. You know what I mean? There were no heated elections. There were no supercharged primaries. There were no vacancies other than this that folks had on their mind. And the fact that we had such a bad turnout across the board, I think the 19th ward, I won't give you the trivia, don't worry, was the trivia question. I think the 19th ward had the highest turnout in the city, and that was 31% last I looked. And mail-ins are going to increase that a little bit, but just think about that. Highest in the city, Rachel, 31%. And the 19th Ward, again, on Southwest Side, a lot of policemen live there. A lot of firefighters live there. You would think that that would generate a big turnout for Burke. And again, John Catanzara for Turner Order Police endorsed her, made it clear how important it was to his the hierarchy of the union to vote for her, pointing out that many of you may want to vote in the Republican primary to vote for Donald Trump, but the real action is in the Democratic primary, so please take a Democratic ballot and vote for Burke. But I didn't see it. I mean, even in the 19th ward, 31%, it's abysmal. So it's I know it's on crime, you're going to get into it a little bit further, is on everyone's mind. The city is struggling with what to do. Oh, cities always seems to be struggling with what to do, what policies to follow, how far to the right do we go, how far to the left do we go, how much do we accentuate criminal justice, how much do we accentuate just lock them up, and throw away the key. You know, it seems like we're always struggling with that. But I didn't see it bringing people to the polls. You know, it's very meager turnout, and it's neck and neck. Harris still may prevail. Is the crime issue, do you think, over exaggerated, or what's your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, if I had to pick an issue that matters most to people, I think it really would be crime. And I know we'll get to this in a little bit, but like some people, you know, Westtown, Ukrainian Village voted to voting in support of like reopening a police district because they don't feel like they're getting adequately policed, and that's leading to or allowing for armed robberies to happen more. I think crime is the thing that people think about most, and I think that that's the thing that scares them most. I think maybe people choosing not to turn out this time around is because of the lack of enthusiasm for who's at the top of the ballot. And also the fact that, you know, in the presidential cycle, in the presidential race, it's basically a done deal. We know who's going to be on the ballot in November, you know, on both sides, both, you know, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. And so I don't know that people felt like they needed to get out to vote for the other things. I feel like on primaries or midterms or whatever, that's often what we see. I feel like that's often you get a lower turnout from people. But I think this time around, maybe people are kind of tired. They're tired of, you know, I don't know, trying to figure out what matters most to them and who aligns with it the most. But no, I think crime is still a big issue. I think that's still a thing that people really think about.
So what is you mentioned the Westtown vote on the police station. What is the impact of that matter to what will it force Mayor Johnson to do, if anything?
I mean, really nothing. It's a non-binding referendum. It's basically like, you know, taking the temperature of these areas. Voters in the several precincts in the 36th ward, which includes or would include the 13th district or the former 13th police district, or open a nearby like 12th police district station. Neighbors in those areas voted to do that. They voted to reopen these sorts of things. And the voters in those areas, including some like Westtown, Ukrainian Village neighbors, are concerned that they're not being adequately policed. And now that they're seeing an uptick in armed robberies, they really want the police response there and able to address these things. So if somebody, you know, calls in and says, hey, I was just robbed, or my neighbor's been robbed, or whatever, they don't want to have to wait a long time for a police officer to come in and to potentially arrest someone, to ask questions, et cetera. They don't want to wait for the justice to kind of begin happening. They want it to happen more quickly than that. And also on the Southwest side, in that same or rather in the same vein, another 60-something percent, I want to say 70% of residents voted for a similar measure to reopen a police district or to create a new police district on the Southwest side. So I don't know, that I think those votes kind of support or inform my opinion, idea of the fact that crime is still a really big deal for people. You know, in 2020, we had a real pivot away from police and policing, and now we're seeing a real pivot back to it. And I think that that's partly because people don't want to get robbed, which sounds silly when I say it that way, but people don't want to get robbed. They don't want to walk around in fear that they could be the next victim. They could be the next person or persons that, you know, you read about on the news who've been robbed in broad daylight.
Now, what ward was it in Westtown?
I want to say it was precincts in the 36th ward who voted in support.
Got it. Oh, yeah. The new 36, which is so bizarrely shaped. It's like a snake.
The pool noodle. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, this is, you talk about a transformation from 2020. We began talking about Iris Martinez.
I know. Yeah.
And this is, this was going to fall in the category of Percival Everett irony. And so on one election, Iris Martinez, in the same day, Iris Martinez is politically punished for moving too far to the right on on issues, particularly by her alliance with the Fraternal Order of Police. And then in another way, so that seems to be like a continuation of sort of the movement of 2020, if you will, in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder. On the other hand, we see voters in Westtown in the sliver of the 36th ward, which is such a bizarrely configured ward, voting to like fund the police, if you will, as opposed to defund the police. So my guess is that most voters in the city of Chicago are in the latter camp. This is just my sense of things. Get your thoughts on it, that they are concerned about crime. But it was not a motivating factor in increasing significantly the turnout in the state's attorney's race. That's so clear to me. You know, without the heated competition at the top of the ticket, like you mentioned, you know, with Joe Biden basically running unopposed. I mean, there were two candidates running against them. Here's a trivia question for you, Rachel, which I won't embarrass you with. Name those two candidates. There were actually three running for president. I won't force you to do that. It's that one is too obscure. But I just, it's like, this is, you know, it wasn't enough to get a huge turnout for state's attorney. But it does send a message about, I think, overall, that one that Brandon Johnson's going to have to pay attention to, and that voters are very concerned. You're absolutely correct about the crime issue. And that leads us to our next topic, police arbitration matters in the city of Chicago. I'm going to need your help in deciphering this one. Rachel, this seems to be constantly changing from one month to the next. So why don't you tell folks what's at stake here in this issue?
So this goes back to the multi-delayed issue that came before city council, I want to say last month, on whether or not to, or rather approving a piece of the CPD contract that would force police officers who are accused of wrongdoing to either go before the police board or rather go before arbitration. And forgive me if I'm getting this wrong. I don't think I'm getting it wrong, but I think I'm like maybe not getting it right in terms of my words. The city council voted to, I think, restrict the arbitration ability of police officers, much to the chagrin of the FOP, who said, okay, like, this is what our contract says. You know, we're, I believe the FOP is not allowed to strike, which makes sense because they are, you know, doing public safety stuff, but they should be allowed to arbitrate privately rather than have those things go before the police board. City council voted, no, you have to go before the police board. I want to say the FOP took that to a judge who like decided this week, officers can either go before an arbitrator or go before the police board, but either way, that has to be done publicly. There is no sort of like private arbitration or public police board process. Both things have to be done publicly, but you know, you shouldn't jump for joy or anything yet, because John Catanzaro, head of the FOP, said that they are still trying to decide whether or not they want to appeal on that matter. But right now, that would mean, you know, the big concern and the big reason why the city council voted to only have these issues or these matters go before the police board. It's not null or moot, but the judge ruled that either way it goes, they should be done publicly so that people, the community, the public, et cetera, knows what's going on and knows, you know, basically the decision that was ultimately decided.
Yeah, in many ways, it's like a transparency issue versus a labor issue. So the labor right of municipal employees to have private arbitration on matters of their employment is enshrined in law. And but what the city of Chicago, its supporters of Brandon Johnson are saying is that this is too sensitive. Police brutality cases are too sensitive to be hidden. And there's a need for transparency so that Chicago can hold people accountable for things they do wrong, or to more to the point, understand exactly what happened in a particular, like a shooting. And so that it's just that the history of police brutality in this city is so deep and so long and been going on for so many years, and it's involved resulting in so many judgments against the city of Chicago, that we can't continue to have a lack of transparency here. This is not like a dispute between, let's say, someone who works for Streets and Sanitation collecting garbage, or you know, a clerk for the Board of Education. So that's sort of the argument at play here. And so, like, good government groups like the Better Government Association, you know, they're being the side of the transparency. And the police union is taking a huge stand on this. And it's interesting because Brandon Johnson and his negotiators gave them a raise in their last contract. And yet the Fraternal Order of Police is acting like the raise was insignificant and this matters more, which I'm quite not sure how to handle that one. Rachel, do you follow me? Like, I would think wallet would be the most important part. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think the potential, like the chance of an officer being fired for something and having that process go publicly, like, I could understand, given, you know, who's in charge of these things, who's in charge of the police union and you know, where they currently stand on matters. I could understand why that's a problem, but also it does seem like in this contract, like, Johnson hasn't been out there calling the FOP president a clown, you know. He's handled things differently. Are there still issues? Of course. But, like, that's the whole, I don't know, not problem with, but, like, that's what happens in union negotiations and in contract negotiations. I was part of them at, you know, the Sun-Times when I worked there, at BGA when I worked there. You don't agree on things necessarily. You take the best option that's given to you. I don't know. I think that changing tack now is to try to, like, gin up support for this push against arbitration. But what do I know?
Rich was alluding to the comments that Lori Lightfoot made, Mayor Lightfoot made regarding the Fraternal Order of Police, not Brandon Johnson, to sort of be a contrast with Brandon Johnson, the clown quote. In passing, before we leave this issue, I noted that the negotiator representing Brandon Johnson in negotiations, a gentleman named Jim Francik, an ironies of ironies in the city of Chicago. Jim Francik's been a labor negotiator forever, worked for pretty much every mayor going back. I think he actually did some negotiations for Harold Washington, but big time Drake Daly and Rahm and Karen Lewis used to tell some delightful Jim Francik war stories about being on the opposite side of the table from Francik in negotiating contracts when she was the head of the teachers union. She got a kick out of Francik, and she loved teasing him. Anyway, Brandon Johnson, who is of course a protege of Karen Lewis, becomes mayor. I would have thought the first person he would get rid of was Jim Francik. Jim Francik endorsed Vallis, if you recall. But no, Johnson kept Francik, and Francik was quoted in the papers today extolling the virtues of the city's position. Chicago politics, sometimes, Rachel, you really need a roadmap to figure everything out, you know.
Just like, constantly strange bedfellows.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Who's friends with who now?
Yeah. And so I'm waiting for Francik to be negotiating with Stacey Davis Gates on a teacher's contract. That will be a price of admission.
That'll be really funny.
Yeah. We're up in heaven. Garrett is going, I can't believe this, Ben. I can't believe it. This is too rich.
Yeah.
All right. So the other story broke in today's paper. Wow, damn. More politics within politics. And it has to do with permits to protest that the DNC, in August. So the Democratic National Convention is coming to Chicago. And follow me in this, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of groups on the left want to use that as an opportunity to bring their issues to the forefront, put pressure on the Democrats, and the issue of Gaza, put pressure on the Democrats to break from Netanyahu Israeli government on other issues too, like economic justice issues, et cetera, and so forth. Really put the pressure on Joe Biden. Brandon Johnson was elected in part by a movement that came out of the left. That's what got him through the first round of the election. But he's now in a different position, Rachel. He is the host of the Democratic National Convention. He will be a central figure in the spotlight when thousands and thousands of reporters, journalists come to Chicago with the delegates. And all the attention is not only on the Democrats and renominating Biden, but on Chicago and how it does. And as such, he does not want a blemish on the city of Chicago to be caused by, I don't know, disruptive rallies, embarrassing protests. So we're having this sort of interesting sideshow where the city of Chicago is doing what it can to deny permits that would allow protesters to get too close to the United Center. Do you follow me? They want to like protest to be away from the United Center, away from the journalists, away from the action, sort of cordon off. More irony. Irony seems to be the prevailing theme in today's conversation. Your thoughts on what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the parade route that they're allowed to do on those convention days in August is like 3 miles away, roughly 3 miles away from the United Center, which is not really near it at all. No, I think this group, the March on the DNC coalition, or the groups that are part of that coalition, I think they know what's at stake here. I think they understand why Johnson and his administration are going about it this way. And I think that's why we're seeing so many appeals and why this is why this has taken up so much space or so much like oxygen so far in terms of how we talk about or what we're talking about when we talk about the DNC. I think in kind of a similar way or a thought that's been coming up for me is, when the Obama Presidential Center was announced all those years ago and people were calling for a CBA and using Obama's words against him and when he was a community organizer saying like, get the CBA, get it in writing, make sure that, these contractors, these developers can't take things away from you. I think that, these groups are kind of doing the same thing with Johnson as an organizer, as a former organizer, someone who's now operating within the system but still has the organizing background. I'm curious to see, I guess, how this plays out. I'll be really curious to see how the convention goes. This is, the whole world will be watching. Is it going to be like in the 60s? Is someone going to, is the mayor going to say, shoot to kill? I don't think so. But I think, and in part because they're trying to avoid having a situation like that at all. But I think that there's a real chance for this to get pretty heated. And I think the mayor's office knows that. I think these protesters know that. I think everybody kind of involved in the planning process knows that. I'll be curious to see, how this goes in August.
One group, according to, I'm going to shout out David Struitt from the Sun-Times, that got approval to march relatively close to the United Center, and I'm reading from today's Bright One, Philadelphia-based Poor People's Army was granted its parade permit last month to march to the doors of the United Center on a technicality. The city missed its deadline to respond to the application and was forced to approve it. That's what they call in tennis an unforced error, Rachel. I'm sure Brandon Johnson is yelling at some lawyer in the metaphorically, if not really. But then the article goes on to point out that probably for security concerns, the idea of marching to the United Center is a relative term, and they actually will not be within the perimeter, the security perimeter. So, I feel it's pretty obvious that Brandon Johnson and the administration is sending a message to the left, which is, please don't embarrass us on the national stage. He's very clear about that. So, all right. Now I'm going to close by talking something non-political, and I'm showing Rachel a copy of this book that I was up until 4:30 in the morning reading. It just arrived yesterday, and I've been singing the praises of Percival Everett for a while. He's truly one of the, in my opinion, gifted novelists in the country today, and everything he writes is just more unique, Rachel, in some ways than the thing he wrote before. Range, his ability, like one day he's like, oh my God, I'm reading Octavia Butler, and the next day, oh my God, it's like Kurt Vonnegut or John Steinbeck. He's got short stories about the West that are straight out of John Steinbeck. Remarkable range. James tells the Huck Finn story from the perspective of Jim, the slave, and Huckleberry Finn. You know, Rachel, I can't wait for you. Rachel shares my love for Percival Everett. I can't wait for you to read the book so we can do a deep dive on it. It's so brilliant. It's really a book about irony. And he's so learned and smart in so many levels. And a book about race relations and white people's attitude toward black people and black people's attitude toward white people. I can't recommend it enough. And I know you're a fan of Erasure, which was the source for American Fiction. So you're going to be reading this book as well, right?
Yep. I'm probably going to order it right after we get off this podcast. You've convinced me to not just go through the library system, but support a local bookstore, which I do more rarely than I'd like to admit. And get it in my hands, and then I'll sell it off to, not sell it, but have my own little library system where I push it on other people.
Yeah.
The Ben Jarofsky way, as I like to call it.
The Ben Jarofsky, right. I like buy books for people. You got to read this book. I bought more copies of Erasure, of Percival Everett, and sent it to
very funny
people. You owe me royalties. Erasure is the book that American Fiction was based on, which
Rachel, I was so glad to see that it won Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yes.
I wanted some more, but that's fine.
Yeah. I was glad it won. I wish the director, the writer, had given a shout out to Percival Everett, but whatever. Minor point. All right, Rachel, anything you want to shout out about your work at Black Club? I know you're an investigative reporter, so you're allowed to keep a lot of it under wraps. Is there anything you want to promote before I let you go?
I would just say the site itself, the neighborhood reporters are constantly doing and finding really interesting stories all over the city. So I would say follow them more often than not. I don't know. This is always when I feel like someone should have given me like talking points. I think I really respect Block Club's work. I really respect the people I get to work with. So I would just plug the whole thing. Go on it, find what you like. We have arts, we have news, we have politics, we have a podcast, a great podcast. Shout out to John Hansen. Those are the main things.
All right, very good. Thank you very much, Rachel. We'll be talking to you real soon, all right?
Yeah, take care.
All right, that's Rachel Hinchin. I want to thank producer Chris as well. Does a great job. And I think Rachel agrees with when I say, hey, producer Chris, give yourself a raise, take it out of petty cash. Peace and love, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Ben Jarofsky Show. Previous shows all available for download at chicagoreader.com. You can follow Ben on Instagram at Benny J Show. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow The Ben Jarofsky Show on your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.